Hello, this is Grady Booch, and this is my column on architecture. Software abundance in the face of economic scarcity, part one. For a few years now, an image has been circulating on the web of a homeless man holding a sign labeled, "We'll code HTML for food." John Dvorak has spoken up as the one behind this photo. It was part of an April Fool's joke. But the image has taken on a life of its own and is typically accepted as true. While staged, it does put a human face on the matter. That being said, by no means am I making light of this man's or anyone's plight. The human cost of the current global economic malaise is very real and quite devastating. I myself have friends, hardworking people with good hearts and simple intentions, who, while not yet on the streets, are dangerously close to it. As reported in The Economist in the 4-10 April issue 2009, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development projects that the gross domestic product of most of its 30 affluent member nations will drop on average by 4.3% in 2009. The World Bank projects the world's economy to shrink by 1.7% this year. At the same time, we sit in a veritable cornucopia of information and technology. According to one report, a week's worth of the New York Times contains more information than a person was likely to come across in a lifetime in the 18th century. It took 38 years for radio to reach a market audience of 50 million, but it took Facebook only two. Now, I'm neither an economist nor a social scientist, so I can't speak with any authority about these things. However, I can attend to where software might fit into this picture, and here's where I land. Software-intensive systems are an inescapable and necessary element in helping us operate, innovate, and even thrive in the face of lean economic times. Let me explain. This is a long story. Well, no, actually, it's a short story that just takes a long time to tell. So I'll let this theme unfold over two columns. The bad economic news continues to roll in. The market has lost more than $8 trillion in the year in value in the last year. Housing prices continue to fall, unemployment continues to climb, and many economists project that recovery will take a decade or more. The phrase "Great Recession" has gained traction. And yet, we've been here before. There have been three periods of great volatility in the market and one serious bear market between 1996 and the present. If you go back further, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has lost more than 40% of its value 9 times since 1885. We had the collapse of the Russian economy in 1998, the bursting of the dot-com bubble around 1995, and the Great Depression of 1929. In a more distant generation, there was also the Panic of 1893, triggered by a serious rot in the railroad business, the Panic of 1857, triggered by bank failures, and even the South Sea Bubble of 1720, led by speculation in the stock of a company that had taken on much of England's debt from the War of Spanish Succession. As Barbara Tuchman notes in A Distant Mirror, the 14th century was not a particularly happy time, what with the plague and constant wars all across Europe, and I definitely would not want to have been hanging around Rome in 476. In his book Collapse, Jared Diamond has similarly detailed the collapse of several societies, some of whom seemingly evaporated from the face of the earth. In the face of economic scarcity, the traditional response is to retreat, shrink, slash, and try not to panic. As General Motors began its free fall, it is reported that to avoid bankruptcy, the government had said GM must shed debt, cut labor costs, and close plants. Even that was too little too late, and GM filed for bankruptcy protection on the 1st of June. There's another, more creative reaction to economic scarcity, and that's to attack. While the velocity of money may have greatly decelerated, and while credit might still be a scarce resource, human imagination is not similarly constrained. As Clay Shirky has observed, we have a cognitive surplus. Producing all of Wikipedia, in all its forms and languages, took about 100 million thought hours. And yet the U.S. alone, watching television, consumes about 200 billion thought hours per year, the equivalent of 2,000 Wikipedias. There's certainly a tension between abundance and scarcity. Innovation in times of abundance is relatively easy. Even just staying alive in lean times is a struggle. The thing about abundance is that, well, abundance feels a whole lot better than scarcity. However, there's a dark side. When you are a reasonable distance away from the financial edge, you feel more confident in taking risks. When you are really far away from the edge, you get fat and lazy. When you don't even believe that there is an edge, you get arrogant and reckless. As Brad Perkins has noted, a recession exasperates competition for limited resources. I agree. But unless this competition results in complete starvation, there are always opportunities on the edge. So here's the thing about software. It's perhaps the most fungible and liquid of resources. The supply of software is limited only by human imagination and labor. Software has no mass, although I'd argue that it does have weight. It's remarkably malleable and wonderfully versatile, and it never wears out. This is why I also argue that software-intensive systems are an inescapable and necessary element in helping us operate, innovate, and even thrive. Now, there are skeptics in every age. In his wonderful lecture, Getting the Network the World Needs, Lawrence Lessig quotes the composer John Philip Sousa as saying, "These talking machines are going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country." More recently, the chairman and CEO of a major entertainment company declared himself to be a guy who sees nothing good having come from the internet. Period. Ouch. Well, I can see why he may say that from his worldview. I have to respectfully disagree. Undeniably, software-intensive systems, even those in lean economic times, are the force behind a sea change in communication and connectivity, and a force that continues to propel innovation. As Ethan Zuckerman notes in his incredible riff on the cute cat theory of digital activism, the web was invented so that physicists could share research papers. Web 2.0 was invented so that we could share cute pictures of our cats. The tools of Web 2.0, while designed for mundane uses, can be extremely powerful in the hands of digital activists, especially those in environments where free speech is limited. He goes on to observe that you can use Flickr to post cute pictures of your cat, YouTube for cute videos of your cat, Google Maps to specify where you took those cute pictures and videos, Twitter to post real-time updates on the cute things your cat is doing, and then, of course, Blogger to wax philosophic about those pictures and videos and tweets. I'd add to his list things such as Facebook, where one can build a global network of people who admire your cat. Of course, these technologies are not meant only for banal purposes. Zuckerman observes that Flickr can also be used to reveal subversive photos that would otherwise be blocked by firewalls. YouTube can be used to post videos of trade union protests, or, I'd add, police brutality, government stupidity, or commercial crime. Google Maps, he notes, can be used to overlay records of land ownership, sometimes disclosing otherwise non-obvious connections. Twitter can be used to offer real-time updates about events, perhaps to coordinate a flash mob. Blogger can be used as a platform for reporting news, subverting traditional media that may otherwise be at best inadequate or at worst controlled by a suppressive government. Lessig characterizes this fundamental change as one in which the consumer is now the creator, leading us to what he calls a read-write culture. Such platforms make possible new and unexpected uses of media, such as DJ Spooky's remix of D.W. Griffith's 1915 film Birth of a Nation, a most remarkable artistic achievement. It's not just about entertainment, however. In the second part of this column, I'll examine other places where software abundance can rise above economic scarcity, and then turn to the role of stable yet flexible architectures that serve as platforms for innovation.